Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, the 6th of June, 2000. We are in the fireside room this afternoon with Bob Ekblad and Lars Clausen as they continue their series on Working Out a Livable Faith with today's presentation, Detoxing from Theologies of Glory. Today's session is CLLA 2000-2. Let's listen in.
Session is titled Working Out a Livable Faith, Detoxing from Theologies of Glory. And Lars and I have talked a lot about just how to, you know, how what the stages are that we want to move through in our discussions this week. And we kind of like the recovery model in a way. You know, detox is actually a when someone who's an addict finally decides to go into detox, they've come to a point of some kind of breakdown or crisis, where they are, you know, they're clearly recognizing their need to, you know, to stop using whatever drug that or alcoholic substance that they're addicted to, and but there's a major transition that a lot of people go through between, you know, when they come to the point of realizing that they're addiction is not livable, and actually moving into the place of detox. And many of us, all of us, are at different stages in the journey. And anyway, what we want to look at is how do we transition from a theology of glory, which is the dominant theology that all of us are familiar with. And those of you that have come for the first time, we're going to kind of give an overview of this theology of glory, the dominant theology that's functioning in our world today. So don't worry. But anyway, we want to understand the transition, how to move from a theology of glory to a theology of the cross, to a theology that is where God is revealed as one who is close and with us and for us, and as God is revealed in Jesus Christ. We've talked a lot among ourselves about how we want to avoid mapping this out too much, because it's not like we're going to create a new four spiritual laws, you know, or just kind of steps towards a new life with the theology of the cross. That's very dangerous. But we see some bearings or compass. We see that what we want to do is sort of point in some directions that we've noticed are fruitful and helpful. Anyway, we'd like to start out by just going over a little bit what we came up with yesterday, based on the story of, we read several texts in Mark's Gospel. One was, the first one was beginning in 17 and 18 and 23 to 36. If you guys have Bibles, it might be helpful just to have a Bible to look those over again. But what we did is we looked at how, had several texts. One is a bunch of, Jesus calls Matthew the tax collector, Levi the tax gatherer or collector, and then he's eating with a bunch of tax collectors and sinners, and the Pharisees, the scribes of the Pharisees are critical, and they say, why are you eating with tax collectors and sinners? And then Jesus says, I've come to save, or to heal the sick and to call the sinners. And then we move on to, we skipped a section, and then moved on to the story of or the text of Jesus where he's going through the grain fields and his disciples are picking grain and eating it on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees are very critical of that, saying, why are you letting your disciples eat on the Sabbath? And Jesus says, well, you know, he points to David and how David and his men went and ate the bread of the presence. And he says that the Son of Man is the Lord over the Sabbath. And the next text is the story of the man with a withered arm who is in the temple, and the Pharisees are watching, they're spying on him to see whether he will do some work or a healing action on the Sabbath. And Jesus very overtly calls the man into the middle of the temple in front of all the Pharisees and I guess everybody, and says, is it lawful to save a man or to, what is the wording of it exactly?
What's the verse number?
It's verse 20, I don't know, chapter 3, verse 2, I think. One. Okay, and again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had a withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. He looked around at them with anger and was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with Herodians against him how to destroy him. So what we were looking at yesterday is, who is the God of the Pharisees? I mean, if the Pharisees were your main way of meeting, of knowing God, the scribes, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, what would God be like? And we made a list of attributes. This God does not associate with sinners. He is holy, pure, and perfect, too holy to kind of be around scummy people like tax collectors and sinners. Exclusive, only hangs out with people who obey the prescribed laws. This is a distant, condemning judge, one who's always watching, right? Like the Pharisees are always watching to see whether there's the laws are being broken. This is someone who's a condemning judge, more concerned about laws than about people. More concerned about obedience and compliance than about someone who's hurting and suffering. In fact, I mean, the fact that they were silent, when Jesus asked the question, well, what is it lawful to save life or to destroy life? And, and they're silent before that question is just indicts them as people that are much more concerned about the laws. Of watching and accusing, hard-hearted. This is a hard-hearted God who you can only be hard-hearted to stand back and stand with the system and with the legal system over and against people. And then in the end, these representatives of this God are out to destroy Jesus. They consider it their duty to destroy Jesus in a similar way that the Apostle Paul saw in his that he was a very zealous believer and felt that was the ultimate politically correct action to destroy Christians, right? So anyway, in contrast, if we look at who the kind of God Jesus reveals, we have a God who, in total contrast, embraces sinners, and sinners are drawn to Jesus, okay? He desires to heal the sick and to call sinners. This is someone who includes everybody, even the Pharisees. A compassionate God, a God of love, who's just out for the people. They're hungry for grain, hey, eat it. A withered hand, it's the Sabbath, okay, stretch out your hand. This is a God who's willing to break rules, okay, in order to, more concerned with people than with the laws. A God who's angry and grieved about the hardness of heart. So anyway, you can see here, just by looking at this story, that there's two contrasting theologies that are diametrically opposed. And yesterday we talked about how I presented how many of the people I work with in the jails and the immigrant community in Honduran Campesinos, Central American Campesinos, have an image of God that's very much like this. God is the God of whatever happens. Whatever happens is God's will. So, if they're poor, it must be God's will. They must be because they're probably bad, and they're under the shadow of this very negative God, and most of them are failing to measure up to that God. And this is like a brand new message that many of them have never heard. When they hear it, it's shocking to them. Okay, so anyway, this I believe, and yesterday we sort of agreed that this was the dominant paradigm. In terms of the theology, the street theology or popular theology. And anyway, one of the things that we began to look at is, what are the benefits of this theology? And this kind of makes it look, it's pretty black and white, that this is really bad, and who would ever want this theology? But of course, this is the dominant theology. So how do we benefit from this theology? One of the questions I often ask, as a pastoral counselor in the jail, I deal with a lot of addicts, heroin addicts, and some of the people, first thing they'll say is they'll be crying, and they'll say, Pastor, I want to stop using heroin. And I'll say, well, how long have you been using it? They'll say, 15 years. This might be a woman in her late 40s or something, early 50s. And
I'll say, well, are you, you know, what makes you finally decide you want to stop using? I mean, haven't you been benefiting from heroin? And they'll say, oh, benefiting? You know, I haven't been benefiting. How could I be benefiting? You know, I'll say, well, anyone that has used heroin for 15 years with all the sacrifices that you've had to make and a huge amount of risk that you've taken, you have to be benefiting. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it. I mean, you seem like a very intelligent woman, and you know, you must be. You must be benefiting tremendously to make the kind of sacrifices you make. And usually they would keep resisting, but I keep pushing and saying, come on, you know, isn't there anything good? And they'll say, well, what do you mean? And I'll say, well, how do you feel before you use? And they'll say, oh, anguish, like I just want to kill myself. You know, I'm pain in my heart. And well, how do you feel after you use? Oh, I just feel like so much peace. It's just a great feeling. I feel like there's not a problem in the world, not a care in the world. I'll say, well, isn't that a benefit? They'll say, well, yeah. Okay, and so for me, it's critical to help the person come to really face the benefits of their particular addiction, because to leave it without really having a realistic grasp of how much you've been benefiting, I mean, you're just going to relapse like that, right? Because as soon as you leave it, then you start remembering all the great things. And so, and the same thing with the theology, moving from one theology to another. I mean, we might feel uneasy with our theologies, but really we need to face the benefits that we've been receiving from those theologies before we get too anxious to switch paradigms. So what are some of the benefits of this God of the Pharisees, the God of glory?
Predictable.
Okay.
You can know the rules and you know what you have to do.
It seems like it would be really easy. I mean, the addicts, I hear them get criticized by the judge, you know, haven't you learned yet? I mean, this is your 50th time that we've incarcerated you. You know the rules. You know, why do you keep resisting? You know, haven't you? And you don't go to your probation officer. You know you're supposed to go to your probation officer. No, I mean, they know it is predictable, but somehow that's not enough. But anyway, I'm getting into we're trying to talk about benefits now. What are the other benefits?
But like, here's the sort of what, yesterday this was all coming out really negative, and just clearly negative stuff. But what does this go with, being predictable? You know, it goes with more concerned about laws than people. Well, I mean, don't you want that kind of predictability? That I know the rules, I know the expectations of when I hire a doctor or when I hire a person for a certain job. I mean, predictability there destroys rule breakers, hard-hearted, those kinds of things. I mean, they go with those pieces, that predictability. So yesterday it was like so clearly, this is bad that the Pharisees are this way. To the person with a withered hand, to the people who are picking grain. But then when it comes down to how are you going to run a church, or how are you going to run Holden Village, or anything, I mean, predictability, that's like big. We want predictability.
What else? What other benefits?
That God is easier to teach to people.
Okay. Simpler to teach or easier to teach?
Mm-hmm. It's easy to teach a set of rules. It's harder to teach compassion.
Logical consequences. You know, you shoplift. You know, you pay, you forge a check for your drugs, you know, time in jail, 3 months, next time 5 months, next time 6 months, next time prison.
Acceptance and reputation. Mm-hmm. You know, you're accepted by a community, mm-hmm. and you benefit because of that acceptance.
Okay, so if you publish enough articles as a professor, then you move up the ladder in terms of your tenure. You're accepted, you're embraced, you're applauded.
Like status.
Yeah. Status.
It's clearer. It's like more black and white. Mm-hmm. Not fuzzy or blurred.
So you know what it takes to please God and to stay out of hell.
You don't have to think.
Well, you have to think, the Pharisees would argue, they'd say, well, listen, we've been trained, this has been an incredible discipleship process that we've gone through to become as skilled in the Torah as we are. But maybe you don't have to think.
In terms of the doing of it, you know where the boundary is. You know.
Okay. You know, but I think you're right. Don't have to deal with ambiguities.
Yeah.
Maybe the inside outside thing. You need to feel good about yourself if there's someone that's not.
Okay, so that's kind of status and self acceptance or whatever. Basically, if you know what the criteria are and you're measuring up to them, and that's being applauded, then that's comforting.
It's fair and just. People get what they deserve.
Fair and just, exactly. As long as you have a good attorney, you can afford.
It's not as vulnerable.
Okay.
There's consequences for actions. You maybe have that down there, huh?
Consequences, well, we talked about clear, not black and white. Let's see.
You probably have it.
Oh, no. Logical consequences, yeah.
You get results.
You get results, mm-hmm. Yeah. You have people that get their doctorates and others that become landed professors, and you have pastors that get better and better calls to more and more established churches or powerful churches, whatever you have. You climb up the rank in your job and your position and all those kind of things, for sure. What was the thing you said? Sorry.
You get results.
Get results.
You get results.
Quantifiable.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that seems like, why would we ever want to leave that? That seems very attractive in many ways. One of the points we made yesterday that I forgot to mention here was Jesus' unpredictability. Okay, he was like moving from place to place, and Mark's gospel articulates that well with the term immediately. He's just immediately going from place to place. It seems like all these interruptions of people in need, and you know, mother-in-law that needs healing, and a leper that comes suddenly and needs compassion, needs someone to touch him and heal him. One of the questions I often ask in the jail is, well, the man with the withered hand, what did he do for Jesus to heal him? What did he do? What were the prerequisites that Jesus had in order for the man with the withered hand to be healed? Do we know anything about his spirituality? What was he doing when he was healed? Was he having his quiet time? Yeah. He was deep in contemplative prayer or something? Or? He was reaching out to the poor. What was he doing? Was he in compliance? And it's amazing. That's a shocking question for people, because normally you think in our society, well, you get what you deserve, and you know there must be a reason for being called or being healed or being fixed or whatever. And there's no reasons oftentimes for Jesus' healing, which makes it much less predictable and harder to teach and less logical. And, well, status doesn't seem to be based on anything measurable. It's just Jesus' will to just say, hey, you're healed, with no criteria.
So yesterday, the difference between those two, I mean, clearly I'd want to be over on the right side. Right? I mean, it was just so black and white clear yesterday as we read that story. But now today, I mean, if you look at the benefits, okay, all of the benefits of that compared to this, and then we ask ourselves, where are we? You know, what is the way that I operate my life based on things? I operate in lots of systems that want predictability. I have to leave at 4:45 to be on dish team, right? So I think an interesting thing to do would be to like stick a number one here and a number 10 here and just call out the numbers. Now, where is it, you know, that I think I find myself? I look yesterday, who's going to put themselves here? Nobody. Hardly anybody is going to put themselves here and say, you know, this is what I want.
Not what I want, but what I am.
Okay. All right. But the what I... So, okay, for you, it's even more here than here. Is that what you're saying, Esther?
Even more what?
It's even more for you in this than in this?
Oh, I'd probably be a two if one was this side and 10 was over here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you don't necessarily want to be there, right? You're trapped.
If I weren't here, I'd say, hell no.
Okay, so one of the questions is, how have we benefited from the dominant theology? Okay, that's something we all have to ask ourselves. How have we benefited? And then the other question is, how have we suffered? You know, I mean, what if we're going to be logical about this, we can look at the pros and the cons. Okay, how have we benefited? One of the other questions we could ask is, who benefits from this system? You know, and who benefits from this system?
Well, it seems to me, though, that one of the things, even though that stacks up very nicely, the thing of it is, it stacks up nicely if you're the insider. If you're not, then you're really out.
Okay, so benefits are primarily for insiders. Okay. Yeah. So.
Right, and so if you're on the outside looking in, you got nothing.
Okay, so here, this kind of thing is especially bad for outsiders. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the undeserving, likely.
Yeah. Bad for outsiders. Who else? What kind of people don't benefit from this?
Well, I've been an insider all my life, and I haven't benefited from it. it's really become a painful burden.
Okay. So ultimately, the benefits can lead you into a crisis of sorts.
I think, I mean, anybody who questions or doubts, certainly they don't have enough faith.
Okay.
So there's, I mean, benefit bad for anybody with doubts or questions.
Is it the fact that questions or inconsistencies in our life or whatever move us from the inside to the outside? And you say you've been an insider all your life, but I'd come back and say, have you been an insider for all your life?
Well, not for the last 18 years or so.
And those are the years...
About a third.
But those are the years in which this doesn't work.
Right.
But prior to this, this worked great. Is that right?
Right.
It worked great. The question then is, if it works so good, and probably more in this category than this. I mean, all these, it's predictable, it's logical, I have the answers, I can do those kinds of things. I mean, the good sides of it are what work. What is it then that makes it stop working?
Change.
Change?
A crisis.
You can't live up
anything different.
Okay. So it's bad for those in crisis, we could say? Becomes a burden.
Or if you start questioning too much.
Yeah, right. Questioners, up doubters.
Those who can't live up to the
recurring
rules.
Theme. Okay, so people who are failing at living up to the rules.
Or people who really, really try hard.
Okay.
To do it and then go another step, another step, another step. Speaking personally. And they just can't do it.
Okay.
Just can't do it.
Okay, so those who fail in the end.
Mm-hmm. But the not being able to do it, trying and trying and trying and not being able to do it, ultimately then I find out I'm no longer an insider.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's
is
right.
What I'm finding out, I'm an outsider. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's that your kids end up being outsiders because they fold under the pressure of trying to be like the parents who are, you know, maybe have this ideal picture of what it is to be a Christian, and the kids can't live up to it. So the parents have to admit that something went wrong because their kids are going a completely different direction.
maybe against the church even.
All right, well, I think lots of things move us out of this camp and into this place where we find ourselves with many of the characters that we find in the scriptures. You know, what would be some of the characters we find in this place of where it's bad news for them? This is all bad news for them.
Anybody who's not pure or perfect.
So,
physically.
So lepers, with men with a withered hand.
Women, most of the time.
Women.
Shepherds.
Okay.
Publicans
and sinners. And
tax collectors.
Okay. So anyway, the question that I want to ask now is what do we stand to lose by giving this up? Maybe I don't want to go into too much depth about that right now, but just that's something to keep in our minds. Sometimes when people are unable to come up with disadvantages to this, there would be
chaos. Some chaos.
Okay. What we stand to lose is a certain amount of order then?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got all these questions that really aren't answers to.
Okay.
Once you move out of this box and you don't have somebody saying, well, this and this and this, can't you see that? And you've all of a sudden got questions and you have people saying, I don't know. That can be very disconcerting.
Yeah, for sure. What is your church?
We stand to lose all of this, actually.
Yeah.
What is your church? If you think about your church, what does it look more like, this list or this list?
That list.
Left side? Any exceptions? Your church is different? Your church is different from that? Okay. Yours is different? Yours is not this list here? Okay.
No. I was just thinking of the church that I grew up in. Prides itself over the years on its ministry that it serves in the 12-step and with addictions, and our pastor has written a number of books on that subject, yet there's still that glory, so there's a mix, like here, you are loved for who you are, but yet the theology that you, those are the programs that occur not on Sunday, but what you hear on Sunday is a little bit different than what you're hearing on the other days of the week in the church.
Lars and I have a few stories we want to tell that kind of hit on that. And I don't know if now's the moment we want to do that, Lars, or what do you think?
Yeah, we could do that. I just really think we've got two interesting lists here that are going on.
When you say our church, do you mean the church at large, or do you mean my local?
Whatever. Wherever you get your message from of what God is like.
And Stacy, what you're saying about seeing it in your church, a church that is progressive and we're on the cutting edge in terms of dealing with addictions and all kinds of things, I mean, this theology of glory is found across the denominational lines and from conservative to liberal. I mean, it's an apolitical category, really, which I think will become more evident as we move through today. But were you going to say something?
Two things. One, I came from a faith that wasn't Lutheran into the Lutheran. And first thing I noticed is every Sunday they preached on the Gospels, not the Old Testament or anything else, or a mixture, and mostly the Gospel. So as long as that's the goal, to present the Gospel, you're presenting grace every Sunday. So that God gets preached, the right side gets preached. So, I think, so my conclusion is, we're all mostly that way to begin with, and then they preach grace, and we try to make it all mush so that we feel just fine.
I think you can preach on the Gospel and not preach grace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think so too.
Yeah, definitely.
Say a little bit about that.
Because so much of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and even John has rules in it. And we can say it's the good news and it's grace, but very often it comes out as trying to live up to this stuff. I mean, that's what I've heard a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can try to live up to a theology of the cross. I mean, I went to a seminary where everything was polarized between theology of glory and theology of the cross, and the theology of the cross people were insiders, and they were very critical of anyone that didn't get it. Okay, so you know, any kind of a systematization of these things, of anything within the realm of theology, can create divisions between insiders and outsiders, and give you a standards that are, that you think you can need to move towards. I mean, that can become a new law. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of things that bring you from benefiting to suddenly be having it be bad news would be, okay, if you're an outsider, if you're undeserving, if you're questioning, doubting, if and those in crisis, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the first step is that you have to recognize your inability, you know, to get free from your addiction, whatever it is. Okay, that's the first step, right? Does anyone know the exact language of that first step?
They're powerless.
Okay, so usually people that come to the place where they recognize they're powerless are people that have come to a crisis. And Lars and I both have had experiences of that we'd like to share, which may help clarify this even more. Lars,
the goal is to be able to kind of put this into ourselves and be able to get language for it, be able to recognize in what's going on in my life and in the scriptures that I read, you know, what's going on. And it's not that one needs to say, well, I'm going to choose this one or I'm going to choose this one. You know, it's not even that one is better than the other. Clearly, for myself, this has become powerful for me. Okay? But there's no proving that. There's no proving that. But to learn to discern and get a language for these things, I just think is so helpful. Because what I sense is that when this finally breaks down, okay, when I'm no longer able to measure up to this, then a lot of times we don't have the language to move over to this place. I mean, who's going to build a church of outsiders, failures, undeserving, those unable to do it, questioners, doubters, and those in crisis?
See, my answer.
Not me, but my daughter, Erica, is at seminary, and she once, her first church to be the all sinners church. And I said, well, who would join? And I thought, yeah, I would.
I know a guy who's done that, okay, in Alaska. His name is Howard Betts. It's this great little church with very few people, and he got kicked out of the church he was in Anchorage. And it's a church which just welcomes everybody, including gay and lesbian people. They published with him a book called Pastor, I Am Gay. They've been disfellowshipped from the American Baptist Church, okay? There's a huge cost to building a church out of these people. I know a guy who came back from a sabbatical in our town. And when he came back, you know, he's real active in our church, saw this article about a new superintendent of schools, you know, that had been hired while he was gone. So he comes in and says to me, I think I'm going to write a letter to this person and invite this person into our church. Okay? There's nothing wrong with that, but what's the focus? You know, I've got a good one. I never have heard from this person. Never, ever. I'm going to write a letter for this person. It's a leader in our church. I just find this stuff all over the place. Mm-hmm. And what makes it subtle is that yesterday it was so clear. You know, in some sense, ignoring, yeah, we preach this stuff and we make it so clear, but why is this such good news? I mean, it is good news. I grew up, became an Eagle Scout. I did really, really well in high school. I got to go to the Air Force Academy. The first year they yelled at me, that was just fine, no problem. It was just one more thing to overcome, right? It was the next year, my job was to yell at the new people coming in. This was not good news, because the question is, why do that? I never had to answer the why question before. I just did all these things. You start them, you finish them, you do well. Why do that? I couldn't answer that question. Then I had to answer the question, why do I have to make my bed for inspection every single day? Well, from there, the whole world opens up. Of, you know, why? Clearly, that's not a question for you yet. You should not be home. But, you know, I had someone who was going to inspect that.
Sure.
Okay. Then the question, why go to school? Why learn these things now? I mean, I could be doing so many other things. What's a degree good for? Mm-hmm. Why wear these uniforms? Why do all those kinds of things? You know, we talk about sort of despair and all these kinds of, I mean, this is just this little mini one of a high school sophomore, or I mean a college sophomore, right? No big deal, but my life was suddenly broken apart. Mm-hmm. All these benefits suddenly were in question. So anybody heard of Josh McDowell? Proofs for the, okay? He came to speak at the Air Force Academy. A friend invited me to that, who was in Navigators. I went, said, you got to give your life to Jesus. Boom, here's all the reasons why. I went home and I gave my life to Jesus. Now, I'd grown up, baptized Lutheran, all these things, but I did that. And I got, before I get there, can you identify the God that I was following as a child?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, is it this God? Mm-hmm. Okay, and I was doing well at it. That's critical. It's funny, but it's critical. I was doing well at it. Okay? Right? Have you had times in your life when you've done well at it? It's worked. So there's no questions about it. The questions come, so I give my life to Jesus that night. I go over with Wayne to the Navigators. It's a parachurch group on campus. And we start learning scriptures, we start fellowshipping, we learn these four spiritual laws that you got to do. Going out, witnessing to those who were visiting on campus, doing all of these things. Can you tell me the God I was following?
Same thing.
Same thing, right? And when I left, in fact, what they told me when I left the Air Force at the end of that year, they said, you need to find a group that's just like this, or you're going to be in deep spiritual trouble. Okay? This is the way. I mean, isn't that the words of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Saying, this is the way, and if we deviate from this way, things aren't going to work. Okay, so I go out and I join the Lutheran Church again. So clearly they were right. Eventually I end up in seminary. And there, I have these teachers who are opening up the gospel for me in incredible ways. And I had a teaching parish pastor, Steve Jackson, who just lives the theology of the cross and taught me all of these things. Well, the complicating factor was that Ann and I, we thought, taking marriage very seriously, moved in together without being married in order to explore marriage. For this is a lifetime thing for us. Well, there was these visions and expectations that you had to sign, and I wouldn't sign them because I could get I could be okay by getting married, but a gay or lesbian person with a partner could never sign that statement. So I wouldn't sign that statement, and I got kicked out. Can you tell me what God was operating in the people who kicked me out? Can you name that God?
Rules.
I was missing sort of the logical consequences. I was not predictable. The rules, it was unclear what I was doing. It was not black and white anymore. Now, I kind of even hesitate to say this because I'm out of the rules and it makes people uncomfortable. We don't want to talk about that kind of stuff. Why can't everybody just do it according to the rule? And the church said to me, you must do it according to the rules or you're out. That, to me, was where I had a profound experience of the theology of the cross. The greatest thing I learned in seminary was through that experience. That these same people who were speaking to me this language, they were teaching me this language. When it came down to it, this was the way they operated on me. They weren't willing to take a risk on me, and they certainly, and still are not, willing to take a risk on a gay or lesbian person who's in a relationship. Now you can say, but that's the order of things. That's the way they're supposed to be. And maybe we're right about that. Maybe that is the order. There's no proving it. But that is the difference between a theology of glory and a theology of losers. That's the difference. Now who does this make sense for? It made a whole lot more sense for me after I became a loser. Didn't make a lot of sense when I was winning. Because the losers could just work a little harder and they could become winners.
Gay people could become straight. People who were living together and not yet married, they could just get married. People who weren't getting the grades at the Air Force Academy, clearly we don't want them flying our planes. You know? Right? I mean, yesterday as I watched these things going up so simply, I thought, but, you know, this is what it's about. This is what it's about. And for most people, we'll stay here just as long as we can. Just as long as we can. And you know what? Sometimes even after this breaks down, we'll stay there. Why? Because we know it works. Or I mean, at least, even if it doesn't work, I know what it is. It's predictable.
And we don't know what else to do.
Right. And what?
And what's next?
My great sadness about our Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is not that we're just a messed up institution, but it's that this is our roots. This is not only Jesus, this is what Luther came out of. This is the whole reason this thing started. And you're going to find that language very often in our church? No. It's the rare place you hear that. Warren, you were saying last night, somebody was coming saying, I don't like your policy about gay people here. And you said, well, I'm not, and we're a huge church and we're not going to give money to this place. And you said, well, you want me to listen based on power, right? He said, I'll listen when the small church comes and says I'm not hearing grace in this place. Then I'll listen. Do you understand the difference? And how hard it is when someone comes and says, well, I'm not going to support you anymore. You're not going to be my friend. Blah, 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 blah. I got lots of other stories I think.
I'm going to tell a short version of another story, which is similar, but from a different perspective. When I was 20, I took a trip. I was going to hitchhike all the way to the southern tip of South America and climb in the Sierra del Torre, down in the south, the southern tip of Patagonia. And I ended up, my whole life changed when I went across the border into Guatemala and found myself in the middle of a civil war. And the death squads were reigning supreme. It was like the height of their activity in 1981 in Guatemala and 1980. And I was just completely blown away. And I had language teachers that were, I found out later, a lot of them were guerrillas, active in the urban guerrilla movement. And their whole role was to educate white folks, Americans, about U.S. foreign policy and sort of how what the history of U.S. involvement was in Central America. And they were very, very masterful at doing that and were just opening my eyes to my own country's involvement in supporting the dictatorships that led to the death of thousands and thousands of people in Guatemala. I was touched to the core by that experience, and it ended up, my wife, Gracie, and I, we were couple, we weren't married yet at that point, but I asked her to fly down and marry me and continue traveling, and we did. I flew up, and a week later, we were back in Central America traveling, and that led to our decision to work in Central America. I had an awful lot of guilt for being a white male American and for being part of this system. My parents were both Republican precinct chairpersons in one of the wealthiest suburbs of Seattle. And I grew up with the party line, you know, kind of hammered into me. And very much this theology, although they've moved beyond that because of a lot of crisis in their lives as well. But anyway, we decided to move and try to work with the poorest of the poor in Honduras. And we moved into a little rural area and to teach agriculture and preventative health education. And we wanted to do kind of lead Bible studies and things like that, but our objective was to just serve the people. And our model, our kind of text was Philippians 2, you know, which says, consider other people's interests as more important than your own and have the same attitude that Jesus Christ had, that didn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but took on the form of a slave and humbled himself. And so anyway, we were into downward mobility, big time. You know, we refused to have any transportation other than hitchhiking and walking. Until finally we decided to buy a couple of horses. We bought a horse and a mule. And so Gracie and I traveled on horseback and walked and would hitchhike into the capital. And we'd only stay in the cheapest possible flop houses where prostitutes were the ones they'd use, you know, for their clients. And we eat at the dives where the cheapest food was served. And Gracie got chronic amoebic dysentery, and I was sick a lot too. And, you know, both of us we continue to strive and, you know, to serve the poor. And our objective, our ideal was that Jesus encounters us in the poor, and so we need to embrace the poor who come to our door. Well, we had thousands and thousands of people that came into our lives over the course of those years, and I remember just giving compost pile horses ad nauseum. I mean, I was giving them every couple times a day, and I got so sick of teaching composting. We both started to burn out. You know, we were kind of coming to the end of our abilities. I mean, we were having to cut firewood for our little wood-burning stove, and, you know, we lived with no electricity, and we didn't have any running water in the beginning, and, you know, but even with all of our efforts to be downwardly mobile, the average Honduran, if you'd say, well, how's it going? You know, Jorge, ¿cómo va las cosas? You know, they'd say, well, great, you know, but they would have amoebic dysentery at the moment, and scabies, and lice, and fleas jumping all over them, and athlete's foot, and they would have just eaten tortillas and beans, and for them, that was just the norm, right? And so for them, the norm was something that we would never be strong enough to get to. And so it was like the law of mobility was killing us. And both of us were just ready to leave. We were like, okay. I mean, if God is in the poor, there are millions of poor people. If the God meets us in the poor and we're in our theology, invites us to serve the God in the poor, well, talk about a way to kill yourself. You know, and that's what we were doing. And it was in the midst of, but before I ask, before I continue, I'd like to ask the same question Lars asked. Which God was I, where was I in this spectrum? You know, we were being lauded as the ultimate kind of radical Christians here in the North, right? And we were getting a lot of status and praise, and we'd come back and we were like heroes, you know, among some of our friends. And, you know, but we were dying.
And getting results.
We were getting results. Our program was incredibly successful. We had thousands of peasants, but in the end, 2,000 families working with us. What happened is we came to the point, which I think is very similar to the point Luther came, when we recognized that we couldn't save ourselves, that we were just damned Americans. And I felt like I was just a damned gringo, and there was no way I could ever be a Honduran, no way I could ever serve anybody and serve the poor to the extent that they needed. You know, I was broken, completely broken by the situation. And it was at that point that I began to hear about this passive righteousness, you know, that is the heart of Luther's theology, you know, that we are saved not by our actions and by our attempts to please this sort of a God, but that we're saved by the God who comes down and, you know, and who saves us by grace. And, you know, and I, little by little, I began to be able to accept that I was an American, a white American male, you know. Still taking me a while to kind of get to the point of accepting that. But, but, you know, I'm on the road towards accepting that. And that happened while we were still down there. And it changed our whole, for me, it changed my whole way of doing ministry. I felt like I just was able to relax and just be myself. And I just dropped my agenda and just started to enjoy the people and enjoy the whole experience of being there. And in many ways, that's when our ministry really began to flourish, not in terms of all the numbers. I mean, we experienced a lot of persecution from the government as well, and struggle and difficulty, but it flourished in the sense of our own satisfaction with our work.
So a question there would be, you know, before and after, was the compost better afterwards? I mean, likely, if I walked by one year and saw this compost here and then came back the next year, Bob had gone and Gracie had gone through this incredible transformation, the compost would be exactly the same. You know, and we focus on a lot of times these results. The compost is the important thing. And this is a matter of the heart, the human heart. But because the compost is the important thing, or the rules and the regulations of our society are the important thing, and because I don't really trust Bob's human heart, you know, I'm going to put a quota on compost. I'm going to regulate the life so that I get the results. I mean, isn't that a lot of, I think that's a lot of what our churches and our cultural institutions end up doing.
Because we're interested in results. Our businesses, our nonprofits, all of these wonderful things. You know, our cooks in the kitchen, we want a dinner every day. And I want that. I want that. And I don't really care whether they use this way or this way as long as I get to eat, right? But do I really trust and have faith that a person is going to make that meal out of love? And by the way, tonight's meal is a meal of love. It's a special meal. And Sua, for the first time, made kimchi for us tonight in this Korean meal. First time she's ever made that in her life, okay? But if you didn't know that, it's just another meal, okay? That's a grace-filled meal tonight. I have two more stories real quick. Because I think it's in stories, in some sense, that we begin to learn to put a language on this for ourselves, okay? There's two different mothers, and their children die, okay? One was a friend in graduate school. I would go out water skiing with this family, and a bunch of us would always go, and the parents of this one person was always there and would water ski. Well, her son got married, and they were driving, this guy and his new wife were driving. She fell asleep, drove off the road, and he died and she lived, okay? She said, you know, I was talking to her one time, way, way before seminary, I wasn't even talking about God, but she said, I just don't believe in God anymore. There's no God that would allow something like that to happen, okay? What is the sense of the God who is no God for her? And she's just simply rejecting that, okay? Another response would have been, what did I do wrong in order that she drove off the road? But that's all this category, okay? So another woman named Grace Tumia up in Nome, Alaska. And her daughter dies. But let me give you a little more background on the story. Grace is this old woman. She's tiny. Her back is so stooped over that when you put her up in a Suburban to take her to church, you know, she hardly comes up to the seat. You have to help her up. When she was a child, her parents died in an epidemic. And she went into an orphanage. And she was raised there in this Lutheran orphanage. When she grew up, she married a man who was alcoholic. She has a daughter who's rabidly fundamentalistic in reaction to all this stuff. She has two sons who are alcoholic, who come into the house and just ravage this house. She has a daughter who died, who was found under the snow in a town far away in Anchorage. Okay? What I didn't realize that when I found out about this, that same exact thing had happened to another daughter some years before. It's just before we left Nome. I went over to her house and just was sitting there, and I said, and she said, all we can do is pray. All we can do is pray. You know, this is her just total reality. And yet in the midst of that, it's not that God has punished her or her children or anything like that. In the midst of that, there's this God who is present with her. That's the difference. And is my friend's choice over here better than this one? I'm not the person to say that. They make different choices.
So one of the questions is, what brings about a transition then from this to that? For me, it was coming to the place of just failing. I was failing it to reach out to the poor. I mean, I was failing left and right. Don't get me wrong. I say I was successful, but there were so many people that I wasn't able to visit. I'd say, I'll be there next week, and I wouldn't show up. But I just found myself failing. And it was discouraging, you know. It's failure is just inevitable, I think, when you're standing before a God who has these infinite demands, right? And this is Martin Luther's story too. The more he became holy in the eyes of the brethren in the monastery, the fellow monks, you know, that the more he was feeling wretched, right? I mean, his confessors, from what I understand, were like, hey, Martin, you know, commit some real sins. You're getting sick of these, it's what you call sins that need to be confessed. And, you know, and Martin came to a crisis in his active righteousness, right? Okay, so one way to end up here is to go the religious route and to be broken by it. Okay, go the Eagle Scout route of Lars and Bob. And to be broken by it, right? But there are other ways to get there.
What's that?
You know, the other ways to get there are just a crisis, a death in the family, or just being on the bottom for your whole life through, right? And so anyway, we don't need to really talk about how to get to the point of crisis. But second point in AA, which I think is really appropriate, is recognize you have a higher power, the need for a higher power to rescue you, to save you from your situation. And where the theology of the cross comes in is that Jesus is presented as the higher power, and Jesus Christ crucified. So one of the questions that I ask to people who are in this crisis, oftentimes in the jail, one of the first questions I'll ask, and which is, do you sense that God is present with you in the midst of this crisis? And usually they will say, no, you know, God is absent. I feel nothing. God is nowhere. And almost always. There's sometimes the exception. But so I see my role as a pastoral counselor in the jail is to help people discern the presence of God with them in the midst of the dark, you know, the blackness of just being in jail. And, you know, in jail, in contrast to prison, in jail, people are really in crisis. Their kids, if they're women, their children are being taken by Child Protective Services and sometimes put in foster care. And sometimes, you know, they don't know how much time they're going to do. They may be going to prison. They don't know whether they'll be in there for a couple of weeks or months or years, depending on what new charges might surface. And, you know, they may be going through divorces. They can't call because it's a collect call system, and maybe their families don't have phones, or maybe there's blocks on the phones. You know, people are really in a crisis, and it's a dark time. A lot of people try to kill them, take their lives, and it's happened in our jail. Okay, so my question is, where is God? Now, most of them have this image of God. So for them, God is the one that has them in jail. You know, where's God? Well, God, what do you expect? I mean, you know, God is these walls. Okay, so my objective is to help them discern, to meet a new God. Maybe to meet God, to meet Jesus for the first time. And one of the questions that I'll ask is, where is God in your life? And when they say, nowhere, you know, I don't know where God is. And they oftentimes will ask me, well, you know, how do you think I can find God? Or I'll ask them, well, would you, you know, or have you cried out or, you know, asked God to show up? And, you know, sometimes, most of the time they haven't, you know, but usually if they've asked for a chaplain visit, they have some spiritual questions, right? So anyway, one of the major moves is learning how to identify this voice of this humble one, of this very different one, this other, to be able to identify that voice and distinguish it from the other voices that are the dominant voices in our hearts. Okay, I mean the voices of the dominant theology are the dominant voices. I don't know how many of you, when you hear a scripture read, the tapes go off in your heads of sermons you've heard, and hopefully those were good sermons, but sometimes they weren't so great. And, you know, there's the dominant oral tradition. You know, we talk about being against oral traditions and being for the scriptures and everything, but in Protestantism, there's a dominant oral tradition that kicks in, and it begins, the tapes begin to play when we hear the scriptures. And when there's a crisis, the images of God begin to bombard us. And usually, often, they're these images, okay? So how do you learn to discern the voice of this other God, of this Jesus, okay? The one that we meet in the scriptures, in this particular text. How do you begin to hear that voice? This is my real interest, is learning how to discern that voice and to get some clarity about that voice. And one Bible study I do, I just want to, we don't have much time here, a couple minutes.
But just as you get ready for that, Luther, and again, I mean, you make these choices and all these things are associated in each side, all the terms, but Luther would call this the movement of faith. The movement of faith. Not that I've got things figured out and that things are working, but that I recognize in my outsiderness all of those things. I recognize that God is present.
So my question is, how do we discern the voice of the authentic one? Okay, the one translation of the Son of Man that I like is the human one. You know, how do you discern the voice of this one who's so human and so real and authentic? You know, the one who loves and who is compassionate, who we can find right there in the heart of the pain and our suffering and the darkness of our crisis. One of the texts that I often use in a Bible study, I do a Bible study on doors, okay? And I'm wearing my door shirt, actually. 320, right? And actually, this scripture is one that I use. It's the first opening scripture for the doors scripture. And I'd like to invite you to just listen to it. Jesus is saying, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and eat with him, and he with me." What image of God comes through in that invitation?
God is host.
God is host, okay. Although God is knocking on the door of the person.
Guest.
As guest, right. What sort of attitude does that guest have at the door?
Humble.
We talk in jail about, well, how do the doors open for you guys? And say, well, when it's mealtime or when we move from one pod to another, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what experience do you have with doors? Well, the last time the police broke through my door, they broke down the door, the Border Patrol broke through our doors. You know, people are used to doors. People that are incarcerated are used to doors being a place that are things that are forced open or they have no control over, right? But here's a door that where the person is given total control over that door, and there's a respectful knocking, you know. Behold, I stand at the door, and I'm knocking, right? If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, you know, that's the only way I'm going to come in, right? Is if you hear the voice and open the door. Or maybe that isn't the only way that it'll come in, but, you know, there's an incredible respect for the person that is present in this scripture, you know. So one of the questions I ask is, well, what is it like? I mean, what have you heard that voice? Or how do you know when you're hearing that voice? How do you know? Does anyone have any ideas about that? How can you distinguish this voice from this other voice? These other voices?
Well, one thing is, it's not a loud voice. So if things... It's not a TV advertisement voice at all. It's kind of the opposite and for me, and so it's something that kind of emerges.
Mm-hmm. I think you feel peace when you hear it.
Okay. So it's a voice that is accompanied by peace. You know, another study I do with the guys and women too in the jail is Elijah in the cave. You know, and Elijah's in the cave, and he's in the back of the cave. I kind of embellish the story, right? But it's like God, the lightning comes, right? And Elijah doesn't go out. You know, it's like, yikes, that's kind of more like this kind of a God, right? And the thunder, it says Elijah stays back in his cave. And, you know, most of the people I work with, they're back in the cave. And everything they're hearing about God is sort of the lightning and the thunder, right? What brings Elijah out of his cave?
Still small.
Exactly. It's this moment, it's this quietness, right? So this voice is a voice of peace, a voice that is respectful, highly respectful. Well, what if we don't hear the voice?
Mm-hmm. I think also that, for me also, it has to do, I worked with an early childhood center, and the most effective way, really, when children are getting lonely, is to start talking quiet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And quiet, because then
they have to listen. And so I think that that's part of it also, is that it's a voice that calls to you for listening. And that... there's a sense for me, a sense of certainty that comes with it. Things come that I know they're not, you know, for me. It's not for me.
The next,
there's something, mm-hmm. something more. That's all.
So there's a feeling of like, okay, I can trust this voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The second text that I often use is from John, and it goes, it's John chapter 10, verses 2 to 4. He who enters by the door of the sheep, or is the shepherd of the sheep. The one who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep, right? To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. When he's brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. Okay, so that's speaking, and that's very much in continuity with what you're saying. There's a sense of like, okay, this feels right, this sounds right. I recognize this voice. This is the right voice, right? But it's not always that crystal. It's not crystal clear. You know, we're in the place of unpredictability and ambiguity, and
it's not always there.
It's not always there.
She's the other thing.
Yeah.
Buechner talks about the alphabet of grace, and he goes back to Hebrews, which doesn't have any vowels. It's just all consonants, and you have to kind of assume kind of what's there, which is part of what makes translation difficult. But I think that there's a lot to be said about looking at our own life, which is all around us. This is the language of grace, but it's part of it is interpreting what you're hearing too, is looking and listening and being aware and understanding that it's not, you know, the it's not the TV, it's more like the painting up there. There's lots and lots and lots of interpretations. But it's not a put in your 1995 and you get this chopper and that 16 blades and this and this all from the 1995.
You know,
it's not like that.
You know, in praying the examine, the Ignatian rule, that's what that's all about, is learning how to examine your life to see where, if, you know, are there any signs of God's presence in my life through what I'm feeling, what I'm observing, what I'm the events.
I was going to say, Jesus is humble and has chosen to manifest through the church. I think when the church is really listening to God, then the church will be responding to those who cry out to God. So for me, the voices, at least in my life, and as far as I can tell, and most other people, is usually a human voice. And that's, I think, how Jesus comes to us, is through people who are also loved by the people who are loved by God. You know, if indeed Jesus manifests in the body, in the church.
I have this.
So for these people mm-hmm. in jail, you know, it's for when somebody comes and says a word that is unexpected, a word of grace, and then they feel like they're encountering Jesus right in there.
I had a man in the jail who was accused of first-degree murder, and he was convicted of that, actually. He was a guy I've known, I've worked with years before in the jail, and he'd gone up and, you know, and gone down the hill and into worse crime, and then that had happened. And I meant to visit him, but I visited him like a couple days after his sentencing. And I just asked him, I said, well, you know, are you feeling God's presence in any way with you? And he thought a while, and he said, well, no, not until today. I said, oh, really? He says, yeah, not until right now, when you came and visited.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't like elevating me in any way, it was just like a matter of fact sort of statement. And, you know, which tells me, which totally supports what you're saying. I mean, God is a God who incarnates God's self and comes in weakness and comes as vulnerable as a vulnerable human one. And it speaks through people like us, you know. It speaks through those that are weaker than us. Right?
I agree with you. It speaks to those that are weaker or maybe have different life experiences. But sometimes there's this strength that you see apart from that weakness in that person that I guess I found myself in seeing someone who I'm like, wow, look at their life situation. This is horrible. But they are so strong, you know. And so it's that paradox of that strength and weakness. And so I liken that to the face of Christ, of this strength and this weakness of suffering, of on the cross being the life condition.
Well, there's an authority that comes, you know, out of suffering. And that authority feels strong, right?
Yeah.
Totally agree with you. One other text that I often give people when they don't hear the voice, I know we're done. One more little thing. There's one more scripture when people say, well, I can't hear the voice. I'm not hearing the voice. You know, the Matthew 6, it says, knock and it will be opened. Knock on the door. It's kind of the opposite of action of the door, right? Instead of Jesus knocking, it's we who are knocking. You know, ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. And that particular scripture for a lot of people is revolutionary. You know, for them to think that they could call, they could ask, they could cry out, they could ask, and it will be, and they can seek, and they'll find, and the door will be open to them. And that's part of the process for many of us too. If we're feeling God's absence, well, we need to take that invitation to cry out and to ask and seek and then be watching, right? And a watchfulness is a whole attitude of a spiritual state of really being alert and looking for and trying to listen for God in the midst of our struggle. And we're going to talk more about that on Friday, but tomorrow we're going to be looking at it approaches to the scripture. I believe that the scriptures are a training ground for identifying God's presence. Okay, so we're going to be looking at how to, some new ways of reading the scriptures that can help us move past some of our impasses that many of us might have. And I encourage you guys to come. And then Thursday will be the church, looking at how to kind of make sense of the church and worship from some of these perspectives. And Friday will be spirituality and activism, reflections on that.